need to make another announcement and let you know that I am not responsible for that garish sign that is out in front of the church this morning. I know who is responsible. He's a very irresponsible psychologist who is really needs a doctor. Thank you. You're a great bunch. You really are.
My mother called me this morning. She said, 50 years ago, you woke me up at 5 a.m. And I said, Mother, I think it's time to look forward, not backwards. I want you to read something to you this morning that I copied down from F. Scott Fitzgerald, who was writing about his own tragic life. And he said, since I could no longer fulfill the obligations that life had set for me, or that I had set for myself, I said, why not slay the empty shell? I must continue to be a writer, because that was my way of life. But I would cease to be a person. This is what I think now. That the natural state of the sentiment adult is unqualified unhappiness. I think also that in an adult, the desire to be finer in grain than you are, a constant striving, only adds to this unhappiness in the end. F. Scott Fitzgerald drank himself to death. I was in the shower day before yesterday, which is where God speaks to me. He speaks to me in other places, but for some reason he likes to speak to me in the shower. Nobody else is there to hear. And I said, well, Lord, I don't want to vegetate. I watch so many people grow old and spend their last years in nursing homes. It's interesting how we call them nursing homes, places where things vegetate. And I don't want to do that. If I reach that stage, I'll just be like the old Indians, and I'll just stop eating and go on to the happy hunting ground. I will not spend my years useless. And I felt God said, no, that's not my intent for the child of God. My intent for the child of God is that you grow old and you contribute up until the day that I call you home, and that you die in a healthy state. That's my intent. I said, that's fine. Now, the irony that I hear of this is that in order to do that which I want to do, which is contribute, that I must first concentrate on some personal disciplines to make that come to pass. That if you do not concentrate on the personal disciplines, you'll never be able to make the contribution outside. Herman has quoted Carl Jung to me on several occasions, and I will not quote him the way Herman quotes him because I can't remember that, but the essence of it is that man spends the first half of his life determining what he's supposed to do, the second half of his life determining who he is. And so it's at that second part that the excitement begins to come in. I want to read to you this morning from the 24th chapter of the book of Joshua. The very close of Joshua's life. He is, let's see how old Joshua is when this is taking place. He's 110 years old. 110 years old. Moses died at 120, and the Bible says that his eye was not dim. And the King James translated, I think there was life still within him. That literally means, you Hebrew scholars, that he was still capable sexually of performing at 120. There's hope for some of you grandfathers. All right? We'll not dwell on that. But Joshua 24, Joshua is at Shechem, up in the land of Israel, what is now the West Bank. All the land has been divided. He calls the elders of the lands together. And in the 11th verse, he says, then you crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho. He's reiterating the history of what they've been through. The citizens of Jericho fought against you, as did also the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. I gave them into your hands. I sent the hornet ahead of you and drove them out before you. Also the two Amorite kings. And you did not do it with your own sword and bow. So I gave you a land on which you did not toil and cities that you did not build, and you live in them and eat from vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant. And who among us cannot nod our head and say, yea, me too? Now, fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living, but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Now Joshua said that at 110. He didn't have much time left. In fact, he's got about 11 verses left, I think. But I'm gonna take a minute over the 12 o'clock magic hour, so if anybody's gonna turn into a punkin, you get out of here ahead of time, because I got something I wanna share with you this morning. And it's very personal, but God has given me some designs, and I've written them down. Some designs for the next 50 years of my life. They're not goals, because goals are things you achieve as a result of a design or a philosophy. If you set goals, you'll never make them. You determine designs for your life. And in the designs for your life, the goals come forth. They're manifested. I talked to Bernie May last night on the phone. Bernie called me from California. He's talking to me about Cameron Townsend. Cameron Townsend, the founder of Wycliffe Bible Translators. Bernie called me 2 months ago and says, Uncle Cam is dying. He's 86 years old, and he's dying. And in fact, I've been working with Bernie and helping him with some of his writing, and I wrote his obituary before I went to Korea, the obituary for Cameron Townsend that could be published in case he died while I was gone. And Bernie called me last night, and I said, tell me about Uncle Cam. He says, well, he's in Sarasota on vacation. I said, what? He said, yeah. So the doctor said he was going to die, but he said he wasn't ready yet, so he got out of the hospital and came on down here. He's staying with friends in Sarasota. They're down at a beach house, and he's out on the beach roaming around. And he said he had just come back from Sarasota. And said Uncle Cam had said to him, these are the things that I'm going to do if the Lord gives me another year to live. He's got an appointment with the president in Mexico. He's going back to Russia for the 14th time. He's learned the Russian language over the last 7 years. Started when he was 79 years of age, learned the Russian language, because he's got a dream that God wants the Bible translated into the languages of the Caucasus. And here he is at 86, and he says, if I have another year, why, I'm going to accomplish these things. He said, we're going to get things straight in Mexico. There's problems between Mexico and the United States, and he's the only go-between right now with the president. And just, I said, that's the way life ought to be lived. Man with a design, a man with a purpose. And so I've jotted down 5 things. And I share them with you not simply because they're personal in my own life, but because I think they're worthy of sharing. I don't have a chance to tell you what God said to me at the halfway point very often. There's only one halfway point, and I think I'd like to share that with you this morning. And these are personal things to me, but they are also things that apply to every one of us who are serious about accomplishing and creating and producing with our lives. Now, if all you want to do is burn yourself out or coast along, then leave. Go on home. Get out of here. But if you're really interested in accomplishing and producing and creating and making a contribution, then these ought to be valuable to you. First thing is this. I have determined that I'm going to explore the depths of prayer. I have toyed with that for a number of years. I have said prayers. But I am determined that I am going to explore the depths of prayer, of contemplation, of touching and knowing and meeting God and of walking with Him. And I don't believe that can be done in groups. I think that's going to have to be done alone, which means that I will do some disappearing for periods of time in the future, because a man cannot hear God while he's talking. And I've realized that for too long I have shared out of revelation rather than out of experience. There's a lot of lessons that have been shared before they're walked out. And these lessons are always incomplete. They're sometimes dangerous. They're always hollow. It's the fool who talks of everything. The wise man first lives out that truth. And then after it has been tested and after it has been tempered and after it has been proved with his life, then he allows it to filter forth from his experiences through tongue or pen. But I have discovered in my own life that nearly everything that happens to me immediately is filtered right back out through my mouth. It comes in and it goes out, or it comes out through the end of my fingers in writing. And God is saying there are many things that happen that are not to be communicated immediately. They're to be held inside. So I've been intrigued with a marvelous little passage of what happened to Mary, the mother of Jesus, who understood these things and pondered them in her heart. And so I'm excited about the concepts of the contemplative life. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I am determined as a design in my life to produce with excellence. With excellence in product. I'm thinking about Cameron Townsend. If a man has but 1 year, he must hurry. But if you have 50 years, and you know that you have 50 years, then you have time to produce something that's lasting. And I'm aware of the fact that I've written too many books in the last 15 years. I've written 31 books in 15 years. That's not good. Because you cannot produce quality things when you're cranking things out. Those can only come with time, and they can only come with agony, and they can only, in the literary field, only come through rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. And so I am determined that I want to produce some lasting things. But in order to do that, I need to concentrate on quality rather than on quantity. 2 nights ago, I finally finished reading Sheldon Van Auken's A Severe Mercy, Laura Watson had given it to me 3 years ago. And she said, God will tell you when it's time to read it. And the book has been on my nightstand, literally on my nightstand for 3 years, covered with all kinds of things, which I'm too embarrassed to tell you about. I weep sometimes that I do not write that well. This is what I was thinking as I read Van Auken's book. It's called A Severe Mercy, if you're interested. I read C.S. Lewis, and there's a deep yearning in the bowels of my spirit to express myself as well. When I graduated from high school, I received three books that I have kept with me constantly on my bookstand. I received a Bible that my mother gave me. I received a dictionary that my older brother gave me, and I received a copy of the complete works of Shakespeare, which a friend gave me. I still have it. I still read all three of them on a regular basis. I read Shakespeare weekly. Sometimes I return to Steinbeck and Fitzgerald and Kipling and Mark Twain, just to prime my literary pump. I enjoy the correct usage of words, and I savor them in my soul as one would savor fine wine. But I read and I groan that I have not yet come up to the standard of combining a literary excellence with a spiritual content. And I am grateful for an editorial friend of mine who gave me some encouragement recently. He pointed out that gifts vary. Some men, such as C.S. Lewis, write with what he called class. They prance through life like pedigreed show dogs in the ring, their heads high, their tails erect, their feet poised. And they're a delight to read. Others write with not class, but with heart. And they'll never win a gold ribbon. They'll never be acclaimed by the intellectual critics. They'll never win awards by editors for semantical pedigrees. Instead of prancing, they nuzzle. They are the mongrel breeds who like to have their ears scratched and wag their tails when you come home at night, and they sleep at the edge of your bed and lick your hand during the night. They're not the kind that you brush and groom. They're the ones who lie in front of the fire and nuzzle you from under the dinner table. And my friend pointed out to me that such writers, even though they may never capture the gift of the metaphor or master the simile or cut with the flashing rapier of the well-honed intellect, they will nonetheless reach the spirit somehow, even with their poor grammar. And to them belongs not the awards, but the anointing. And so I have finally, on my 50th birthday, realized that I am of a mongrel breed, and that licking hands and wagging my tail, I shall be content to nuzzle rather than to prance and to continue on with my fragmentary sentences and let it go at that. That too is a degree of excellence, and I shall find my gift and shall walk in it. Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote in the chambered Nautilus, "Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul. Leave each new temple nobler than the last. Shut thee from heaven with dome more vast, till thou at length art free, leaving thine outgrown shell by life's unresting sea." Moving on to that which is excellent. I challenge you with it as a goal for your life. Third thing, and God has said to me very specifically, is to discipline my life. to explore the depths of prayer, to produce with excellence, to discipline my life. And that is personal, to discipline it in areas of diet and exercise and obedience. I read something that Abraham Lincoln had written not too long ago where he says, I am not bound to win, but I am bound to be true. I am not bound to succeed, but I am bound to live up to what light I have. Discipline. I'll not reiterate on that until you have seen it in my belt buckle. The fourth thing is this. I am required to keep a vision. To keep a vision. And that means to have a vision small enough to become a reality. Because for the larger vision, a man often has to sell his soul. We spent a day this last week on the campus at Oral Roberts University. I'm very grateful for it. I'm grateful for the City of Hope. Our four children have gone through school, or Sandy is still in school there. I'm grateful for that. Grateful for a man who has a vision, a big vision. But every building on the campus has a man's name on it. For that's what you have to do to raise big money. You have to grant somebody immortality by putting his name on the outside of the building and calling it this hall or this auditorium or this building. And I choose not to do it that way. I choose not to sell my soul for money, or to prostitute my worth, to raise money. And the only way that you can exist then is to keep your vision small. Small enough to become a reality. And then let God enlarge that, if he chooses to do so. William Ellery Channing wrote something that he called my symphony. To live content with small means. To seek elegance rather than luxury. And refinement rather than fashion. To be worthy, not respectable. And wealthy, not rich. To study hard, think quickly, talk gently, act frankly. To listen to stars and birds, to babes and sages with open heart, to bear all cheerfully, do all bravely, await occasions and never hurry. In a word, to let the spiritual, unbidden and unconscious, grow up through the common. This is to be my symphony. One other thing, which would be number five. And I am determined above all things, like Joshua, to please my Father. I talked to you several weeks ago about this whole concept that all men are somehow unconsciously still trying to please their fathers. The role of the daddy I have understood, and now the role of the granddaddy, is to call forth the spirit of the child. Mark it well. The role of the father is to call forth the spirit of the child. I don't teach my children to pray. I pray, and I let them see me while I do it. And that calls forth the spirit in the child to pray himself. I bless my children. I cry for them. I rejoice with them, and I let them see me in the process. I hold nothing back from my children. Everything within me is theirs. If I hold anything back, they are the poorer for it. And so they see me not only at my best, they see me at my absolute worth. They hear me as I fuss with their mother, and as I lose my temper, and as I do my ugly things. And then they see the greatness and the glory of God. Take someone who has utterly failed and do something with that individual, and they come to that place to where their own spirit is called forth, and they say, I too can go on, because I have seen a man stumble and fall and God pick him up. And if God can pick up my daddy, he can pick up me. So they see me, and their spirits come alive, not because of me, for it's not with the sword and the bow that the cities are conquered. It's by God's might and God's power. It happens through God. And hopefully in seeing a man, they will see God also. I'm going to embarrass my older son, Bruce, by reading a letter. Did you read this? Well, you hear it this morning. He wrote me a birthday letter. Bruce is working with Bill in Washington. I've been in Washington now for almost 6 months, and I've not yet been able to call it home. In fact, the longer I'm here, the more I am realizing the only true home I'll ever know is when I'm with you and Mom. And that could be anywhere in the world. I think of you often and remember the things you would say that, truthfully, I didn't quite understand at the time. He's 26 years old. Still single. I remember your insistence in my squaring the edges of a drainage ditch, even when it would soon be filled with dirt, and learning to build a perfect fire, even though it would soon be a rubble of ash, or even packing a perfect suitcase when later that night it would be unpacked. I wish you could have heard him. All these I remember and more. However, I am now beginning to realize that you were not so concerned with the actual evenness of the sides of the ditch or the balance of the firewood as you were with the attitudes behind the making of these. It is that attitude that I am now purposefully, consciously developing in myself. I suppose that what I'm trying to say is that I'm learning to tell the difference between those things that seem important and those that are merely urgent. I have friends who spend their entire life, so it seems, on trying to convince others of the urgency of silly philosophies, or try to force ideals that take years to develop into a single conversation. They miss the core of their own practicality. They are defending outward appearances. But I see now, because of you, that it is the inward attitude that motivates that appearance which is important, the heart of the matter. There were times in my life when I couldn't understand why you were so insistent on me doing small, seemingly unimportant chores, such as making up my bed. However, I know now it wasn't the bed that was so important, even though sometimes it really was, like when we had visitors in the house. But you were interested in me. I realized that your love for me and the other kids is so great that you were willing to gamble on my totally misunderstanding your intentions in hopes that I might be able to take what my friends have fallen into and rise above the mediocrity. You gave me the chance to attain greatness in spiritual ideals, and you didn't attempt to do it in one sitting. I owe myself to the investment you made in me over the past 26 years. Perhaps I'm making all this too dramatic, or maybe I've missed the point altogether, but one thing I know for sure, and that is my love for you and Mom extends far beyond that which I've been able to display. And my respect and appreciation for what you've taught me causes me to want to be exactly like you. I pray that the values and traits I see in you will be brought to life in me, so I too can show them in my children someday, with the same consistency and patience you displayed. I can think of nothing better to give to my children someday than the same gifts of life that you have given to me and that my father gave to him and his father to him. He wrote a P.S. Several years ago, you wrote a letter to me just before I was to leave for summer camp at Ridgecrest, North Carolina. I was only 11 years old. But I was terrified of leaving home. You couldn't be there when I had to leave. But you sent me a letter. You described your experiences when you were a young boy going to camp. And you opened my eyes to the great fun I could expect. You made what was to be the worst experience in my short life turn into the greatest adventure a boy could expect. Well, I went on to camp with Mother B and Daddy B, my parents, and indeed found myself in one of the most enjoyable places ever. One of the first afternoons there, I was in my bunk after a hard morning of football, and I looked across to the other side of the cabin and I saw a guy my age crying into his pillow. I remembered how I had felt and knew he was more likely than not homesick. I took the letter you had sent me and stepped across the room. He looked up and I asked him his name. He said, Chuck. I pulled the letter out of my pocket and handed it to him. I told him to read it, but where it mentioned my name, to use his, Chuck. After he finished, he looked up and smiled, and we ran out to the lake to swim. For the first time in my life, I realized the power of a man of God. I knew that things you were telling me were not only good for one boy from his father, but for the whole world. I'll probably never see Chuck again, but I know for a fact he'll never forget a man he never met, sitting in his office, who took the time to write a letter to his son. Thanks from me and Chuck, Bruce. Now, I trust you understand, and I expose myself to you, that I did not do it with sword or bow. But I live in a city that I did not build, and I eat from vineyards and olive groves that I did not plant. Let me give you something from Longfellow and we'll go home. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime. And departing, leave behind us footprints in the sands of time. Footprints that perhaps another sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, seeing shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. If serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourself this day whom you will serve. Whether it be the gods of your forefathers or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Stand with me, will you please? Jimmy, play for us for a minute and wait very quietly before God before you slip out.